97.1 FM Talk. On demand audio.
All right, doing our best to get comfortable here. The brand new control board, which makes things a little different than they used to be. The audience doesn't care. That's why my boss would tell me, Mark, stop talking about changes in the studio. But this is my first day back since Wednesday. So you've had to deal with it here for longer than I have.
Yeah.
So we're going to do our best. We got some hiccups, some things that are going on. We're going to get through it. We have, of course, Sue's News in the next hour. I got a bunch of different things because, as you might imagine, since I wasn't here on Thursday and Friday, I've been making some notes to myself. Sue will get all caught up in the next hour. In the 5 o'clock hour tonight, John Ziegler will be here, the co-host of the podcast, The Death of Journalism, good friend from out in California. And then the other thing that I saw a lot on television over the weekend were ads for Winning for Missouri Education, which, a.k.a., was legalized sports wagering. They're spending a ton of money on that campaign, so we're going to get into that in the 5 o'clock hour, plus an audio cut of the day and more. Right now, we welcome back Josh Hammer, Newsweek Senior Editor-at-Large, host of The Josh Hammer Show. You hear it every Saturday, 1 p.m. on 97.1 FM Talk. Josh, how are you this afternoon? Welcome back.
You know, Mark, I'm a little under the weather, but there's no such thing as too under the weather to join you, my friend.
Well, I appreciate that, certainly. And let me start. I want to get your thoughts. I always find it interesting, your thoughts on the election. But let's start with what's going on in, in Lebanon and related to the Israeli conflict. You have 274 people killed in Israeli strikes. You know, Josh, in a weird way, there's some of this, and I wasn't paying as close attention. But I started reading newscasts and, you know, doing things on the radio in the 1980s when bombings of Lebanon were very common. It's almost bringing me back to that point at this point where, you know, you have so much going on over there. And now, let me say this, it's almost like people in this country are kind of tuned out a little bit because of everything going on here with the election.
So the media and the political class more generally, Mark, for the past year have overwhelmingly focused in Gaza and the threat from Hamas.
Right.
But it was the world's worst-kept secret for those in the know that the real threat, the real danger, was actually coming from Israel's north, from Hezbollah. Hezbollah has over 100,000 precision-guided missiles in their arsenal. They are orders of magnitude better armed. They are orders of magnitude more sophisticated than Hamas. Unlike Hamas, which receives funds from Iran, from Qatar, and various other rogue actors, Hezbollah is a straight-up Iranian proxy. So they have extraordinarily close ties with Iran. Hassan Nasrallah, who's the head of Hezbollah, is very chummy with the Ayatollah in Tehran and so forth there. But, you know, I think the most important fact for the listeners to bear in mind here, because you're going to have all the usual suspects, the left-wing idiots who are going to be saying, oh, Israel's trying to start another war here. Well, the reality is that Hezbollah has rained roughly 8,500 rockets, missiles, and drones on Israeli civilians since October 8th, literally the day after the Hamas massacre in the Gaza envelope. You know, when I was over there in January, which is the last time I was over there, all the Israelis I spoke to were talking to me as if the situation in Gaza, they'll figure it out. I mean, they will reach some situation there. But the real problem was that 60 to 80,000 Israelis living in the north, in the Sea of Galilee region, in the Golan Heights region, they've been displaced. I mean, they have not been living in their homes for almost a year now. And, you know, look, I don't think it's going to reach a full-scale Israeli tanks start rolling in ground war. I could be wrong about that. I could definitely be wrong about that. I am thinking that Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, is probably going to stand down. But before that, I don't think that he wants a war just as much as Israel does not want a war right now. I mean, Israel has taken out some very, very, very top Hezbollah commanders just over the past week. They took out Ibrahim Akil on Friday. This is a man who the FBI had a $7 million bounty on his head because he was instrumental in the 1983 bombings of the U.S. Embassy and the U.S. Marines barracks in Beirut, which slaughtered 241 U.S. Marines. Israel took him out on Friday. They took out multiple other high-profile commanders over the weekend and Monday. So I'm thinking here that Hezbollah is more likely than not to not risk the actual tanks rolling in a third full-scale Israel-Lebanon war, but I could be wrong about that.
Yeah, what you mentioned there, I want to focus a little bit on the northern communities because the geography, I think, is a little tough for people who are not paying attention to this. And just the information that 60,000 Israelis have been displaced because of the threats from Hezbollah, I think a lot of people would be surprised by that because that's an undercovered aspect of this story, as we sort of indicated, isn't it, Josh?
it, you know, people don't talk about it, Mark. It's pretty crazy. But I can actually, you know, I can be a little personal with you. So, my wife, who is born in Israel, she was raised mostly here, but most of her family is still over there. So the Jewish holidays start in a little over a week. We have our New Year, Rosh Hashanah, which starts a week from Wednesday. And my wife, I guess it's her cousin, and then her first cousin once removed, technically. They're planning to fly over here later this week, but they're flying over from a town in the Israeli north. That's where they live. It's called Kiryat Atta. Kiryat Atta has been directly targeted by Hezbollah. I mean, the Iron Dome missile defense just over the past week has been going off every few minutes, seemingly. And, you know, the question right now in our family, in our extended family, is whether or not they're even going to be able to make it. In fact, her son actually just had his bar mitzvah a few months ago. This is going to be his big bar mitzvah gift to come over to America for the first time, see Florida, see New York. So we're kind of on pins and needles to see whether that whole situation plays out. But, you know, that's just kind of adding a little bit of a personal element here. You have 60 to 80,000 Israelis who are not there. And when you zoom out, Mark, and think about what the Iranian regime's long-term goal is, you know, it's not necessarily a single Hiroshima-Nagasaki-style strike. It's death by 1,000 cuts. They view this as a war of attrition, where you essentially break down the Israeli psyche with massacres like what Hamas did on October 7th, with the massacre that Hezbollah was planning on doing in the Israeli north as recently as last week before Israel launched the pager walkie-talkie operation and amped up their game. They got intel that Hezbollah is planning something very similar. They want the Israelis to retreat and recede from their borders inch by inch by inch. That is the way that they ultimately hope to get to Jerusalem and finish it off.
Meantime, in another conflict across the planet, is it just me, or is Zelensky coming to this country to campaign for Harris and Biden, essentially?
It certainly seems that way. I mean, signing the whole, you know, the missile with Josh Shapiro earlier today in the munitions factory in Pennsylvania. You know, another friend pointed out to me that the optics of this are a little odd, isn't it? Is that Donald Trump, you know, the world has moved on, but Donald Trump had a second attempted assassination 8 days ago, I guess it was, on my math. And, you know, among the causes that he was associated with, probably the number one cause, was that he was over-the-top zealous for the Ukrainian cause. I mean, he literally flew there trying to recruit Afghans to go fight for Ukraine. He was trying to kind of shepherd them in through Iran to fight the Russians on the Ukraine's behalf. He was saying all of the various pro-Ukraine platitudes and whatnot there. And I think the optics are just a little weird, that the opposition party is now openly appearing on the stump with Zelensky, the guy who tried to kill Trump, was in turn going over the top to do all of his various deeds for. Now, I am not impugning everyone who is ardently pro Ukraine. That's definitely not what I'm saying. But I do think the optics of this are a little weird, and it's definitely unprofessional at the least. It is disgraceful, you might say, at the most, for a foreign leader to try to get involved here at a time like this. I mean, to kind of compare real briefly, I mean, you know, Bibi Netanyahu would obviously prefer that Donald Trump win this election. That's not exactly a well-kept secret, but he would never appear on the campaign trail.
Right. Yeah, it's weird. It's definitely weird. There's no doubt about that. Let me just get your thoughts on the overall state of the race. Here we are, 6 weeks away from the election. Here's some news that I haven't shared with the audience. I don't know if this is positive or not, but there's a cookie poll that they do in Cincinnati, and that poll has predicted every election except for the last one since 1984. Trump's leading in the cookie poll. He's got some other polls that are somewhat encouraging on this Monday in swing states, but then I also went off on the fact that we're 6 weeks out and he's hawking mint coins on his social media instead of focusing on the campaign, Josh.
Yeah, I saw that, and, you know, I roll my eyes basically through the back of my head.
Me too.
Presumably there are things that are better worth Donald Trump's time than that. There's really just no other way to say it. I don't really know what else to say. I mean, what a bizarre thing to do. But, I mean, having said that, Mark, I actually think that Donald Trump is in decent shape right now. I really do think that if the election were held tomorrow, that he would win. I do not claim super high confidence in that. My confidence level is probably around 65%, so I am not overwhelmingly going to bet the ranch on it or anything. But if you look at the highest quality pollsters, New York Times, Siena College poll comes to mind, they do show Trump up or right there, like within 1 point at the very most, within the margin of error in essentially all of these states.
Yeah, Pennsylvania,
Pennsylvania is the biggest state, Mark. I mean, Pennsylvania essentially could single-handedly determine the election right now. I think that you have to think that in a state like Pennsylvania, all of the late-breaking undecided voters end up voting against the incumbent party. That's usually what happens in a presidential election cycle. The white working class vote, if Donald Trump can get back to those 2016 margins even slightly, because those margins have actually come down a little bit, but if he can focus on the white working class there, his bread and butter in Pennsylvania, I think he's in good shape.
You know, I'm going to share this with the audience in a little bit, but there was a focus group that came out of Pennsylvania with African-American undecideds in theory, and I was really struck by the fact that they were some of them were very suspicious about, and they should be, the quality and the caliber of Kamala Harris's leadership. In other words, they said that she looked weak, which I think she does. But it was interesting that that kind of bled through to that focus group, Josh.
So, you know, the young black men demographic is actually very interesting this cycle. I mean, you have upwards of 25% in some polls breaking for Trump. I mean, that would be historical numbers. For a Republican candidate. You know, more generally, a lot of these focus groups, especially in the aftermath of that debate, you know, the Kamala-Trump debate, that the media immediately clamored in unison that Kamala Harris wiped the floor with him. But all the focus groups that were polled, you know, they were not so certain.
I know.
There was a New York Times focus group. There was a Reuters focus group. A plurality, if not majority of them, all said that Donald Trump won that debate. So I think the media are ahead of their skis. I think Kamala Harris's popularity, her favorabilities have probably peaked at this point. I really think over the next month and a half, it's going to start to tilt incrementally, but on a day-in, day-out basis towards Trump.
All right. I love the optimism, Hammer. We'll hear you on Saturdays at 1 p.m., the Josh Hammer Show, every Saturday afternoon right here on 97.1 FM Talk. Josh, appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Talk soon, Mark. Thank you.
Get more at 97.1talk.com.